welcome to the Cubs Weekly Podcast presented by Winchos, proud legacy partner of the Chicago Cubs and exclusive home of Cubs Checking. I'm Andy Martinez, joined by Tony and Drackey, and we have a special edition of the podcast where we're talking to another Cubs alumni, Jody Davis. You've probably seen a few of these that have been coming out throughout spring that we talked to at Cubs convention. Jody Davis is an interesting name because he was a big part of that 84 team that was really a monumental team. I think it's fair to say that for the Chicago Cubs history. Tony, what were you most excited to chat with Jody Davis about?
You know, I think we talked about this a little bit on the Bobby Dernier podcast, but just like the 84 team, I didn't know much about it. I wasn't alive then. You weren't alive then. Like, but I know it was really impactful. And Jody Davis was one of my mom's favorite players. I had heard about him growing up. I remember getting a card and like my mom and uncles were like, "Oh, you got a Jody Davis card? Like, that's awesome," when I was younger. And so like I had known quite a bit about him, never really had the opportunity to meet or talk to him. So I thought that was like a cool personal aspect going into this interview. But then also just like he was an interesting guy. I mean, he threw out 89 runners in what, 1986 season, like 89 guys who were trying to steal on him. That's mind-boggling right now. Like, I can't, I almost said mind-boggling, like from that Will Ferrell quote from that movie, like when your thoughts get trapped up in a bottle. But it was mind-boggling. But like all that, I mean, being the catcher, like catching Rick Sutcliffe coming over, winning the Cy Young in a half season, hearing Jody Davis's perspective about that, it was all of that kind of stuff was pretty cool. But just learning more about the 1984 team as the 40th anniversary of it this year, that's what I was looking forward to. I just think it's one of the more fascinating years because I don't have any personal experience to it. Like, I know everything about the Cubs teams in the 90s, obviously the 2000s, and you know, since 2011 I've been around the team covering it, but I don't know anything about that team except what I've heard. And it was cool to talk to these guys and hear more from them about it.
Yeah, it's really fun to hear from these alumni. And without further ado, let's get to more from Jody Davis.
Hey everybody, welcome back into the Cubs Weekly Podcast. I'm Tony Andracki here, joined by Jody Davis, a two-time All-Star, Gold Glover, former Cub. Jody, first off, what's it like coming back to Cubs convention as a former player, but just interacting with fans here?
Oh, it's great. Cub fans have always been great to me throughout my career. And every year we come back, we say it can't get as crazy as last year, but it always seems to. Cub fans are great, and they just keep coming out, and this is a great event.
I know it's been, you know, a few years now since you've retired, but how do you kind of keep yourself busy? Do you watch a lot of baseball? You follow the Cubs a ton?
Well, I don't watch as probably as much as I used to. I keep up with it, but it's not something that I have to watch every day. As you get older, you know, I guess you don't stay quite as involved with it, but, love the Cubs and love where they're going.
How often do you make it out to Wrigley Field nowadays?
It seems like I get back there about once a month for a series, so love Wrigley Field and the fans. It's good to be back.
So we were talking just before you came on. So there's the 1984 panel. Obviously, this year's the 40th anniversary of that team, and that's meant so much to a lot of fans, a lot of Cubs fans out there, that season in particular. What was that year like for you to just kind of live through it, and then what things have you heard from fans just about how impactful that year was?
Well, it seems like all the fans, especially the older fans, talk about, you know, that was their year. That was the year that we had so much fun. Being a player on that team, the team just really came together. Dallas Green put the pieces of the puzzle together. He started in spring training when he brought Bobby Dernier and Sarge over, and then, you know, he picked up Sutcliffe in June and then Eckersley. And being a part of that team, we were really close. We were really hungry. At that point in everybody's career, you know, we had been established enough that we were really thinking more about winning. And being in Chicago, they hadn't been to the playoffs in 39 years, actually watching the fans and the city start to realize that maybe we had a chance, you know, maybe we can compete. And a lot of things went our way, and just a magical season.
What's it going to be like to get on a panel here? We're talking to you a little bit before the panel in the afternoon here on Saturday at the Cubs convention, just to chat with a bunch of your teammates from the 84 season and talk with Cubs fans and answer their questions.
It's going to be a blast. Like I said, that season was so much fun, not only for us, but for the fans and Chicago. And I'm sure that we'll be hooting on each other a little bit and probably telling a few lies along the way, but should be a good time with old teammates.
Is that always one of the best parts about the convention for you, is to get back here with teammates, but also to reminisce on years like 84?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, everybody is kind of scattered out all over the country, and for the opportunity to get back together, and like you said, especially this year, 40th anniversary of that 84 season, should be a lot of fun.
So in the 83 season, you guys lost 91 games. At what point, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, Dernier and Sarge and stuff, at what point did you start to realize that 84 had the potential for something special for that group?
Well, like I said earlier, it was, you know, Dallas put the pieces of the puzzle together. The 83 team, we were fighting the Mets to stay out of last place at the end of 83. And then we went into 84, and, you know, Bobby Dernier and Gary Matthews was just a huge pickup. It gave us a leadoff man in front of Rhino. It gave us a veteran leader that knew how to win. And like I said, then Dallas got Sutcliffe and Eckersley and the pitching, and it was just magical how it all came together.
So obviously that year too, the Sandberg game was a huge part of 84 season. You played in that game. What was that like to watch that performance from Rhino, but also just the atmosphere at Wrigley that day?
It was crazy because there was a lot of people leaving there before Rhino hit the first home run, and me being a catcher, I was going crazy trying to figure out how to get Willie McGee out. he hit for the cycle that day, and if it wasn't for Rhino, it would be the Willie McGee game. But you know, it was just a great game, and we kept fighting back, and it was a game. And at that point in the season, I think everybody, all the fans and Chicago, started to think that we could compete. And, you know, it just steamrolled from there. And everybody started thinking we can win, and just a ton of fun.
So you felt like that game in particular had like a springboard effect for the rest of the season?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we all felt as players that we could compete and we could hang in there. But after the 69 season, I think a lot of the fans started to doubt, you know, because we heard that down the stretch too. And, yeah, you know, oh, they're going to blow it like the 69 bunch. But that was just crazy how that happened for those guys in 69. But like I said, the veteran leadership, so Sarge, Larry Boa, and then the younger guys like myself, Rhino, Lee Smith, Leon Durham, Keith Moreland, you know, we just had great years. And played really good team baseball. We were really close and wanted to win, and it was just so much fun.
You touched on it a little bit, but, like, obviously one of the big things about Chicago, and even back then, the lovable losers label, the fact that it had been so long with the championship drought, how much was that something that you guys were conscious of, or you individually? Did you talk to your teammates about, did you think, like, hey, you know, this has been a while, and there are all these cubby occurrences in the 69 season, all that stuff that's transpired?
Well, we didn't think about it much because, as a team, we thought we could win. We thought we could beat anybody, and that's the way we approached it. Sure, we heard all of that, and, you know, like I said, I refer to the 69 team, but it'd been, 39 years since the Cubs went to the playoffs. And so, I mean, it was – as a team, we knew that was there, but we didn't really pay much attention to it because we thought we were headed in the right direction.
So you mentioned just how Sutcliffe was acquired and – Cubs traded for him. He ended up being obviously a super impactful part of that team, of that rotation. He had a ERA over 5 in Cleveland before coming to Chicago, then went 16-1, a sub-3 ERA. You caught every one of his starts with the Cubs that year. What was it about him that after the trade he just turned it on and turned into the Cy Young?
Well, I don't think he did anything different. I don't think he did anything to turn it on other than now he's in a competitive atmosphere. Like I said, this bunch of guys just really meshed together really well. We had one goal every day to try to win the game. And I think Sutcliffe was, and his attitude, his competitive fire was just, a plus for everything that was going on here. It was just a missing piece. And, you know, Rick's always been competitive, and I'm sure he was just about the same in Cleveland. It just, you know, at that point, our team was coming together better than Cleveland was, so great, great pickup.
What was Sut like as a teammate, and do you have a favorite Sutcliffe stories that you can tell, family-friendly stories on the podcast?
Because I was going to say that.
Yeah.
Not too much. Sut was a big prankster, and there was a lot of pranksters on that team. when Sunt wasn't pitching, he'd joke around, you know, and he'd be pulling pranks on people. And Rhino was a big prankster, too, and nobody suspected Rhino because Rhino's always quiet, sitting in the corner, you know, oiling his glove or something, just taking it all in. But, again, I go back to how close that team was. You know, we were a bunch of brothers, and we wanted to win, and we got real close.
Kind of along those lines, it's hard to quantify how much chemistry of a clubhouse of a team could translate on the field or impact a team that maybe makes a deep playoff run. How much do you think that matters? Because you've touched on that just several times here. The 84 team was close. You were brothers. Did that help lead to your success? Does that help on teams?
Oh, without a doubt. I mentioned the veteran guys, Larry Bowe and Gary Matthews, and those older guys, they were used to winning in Philadelphia, and that's what they expected to do. And it just all came together that, you know, the younger guys, we were hungry to win. We had had enough time in the major leagues that we'd kind of established ourselves. So we knew we were pretty much going to play. And now once you're in the lineup, you got to win the games. And so just that veteran bunch. And, you know, if you didn't do what the game situation called for, those older guys would be in your face, you know, and held you accountable for it. So, you know, just a great combination.
What was that playoff run like in 84? Like, we know how it ended up, but, you know, how did that, I guess, play out from your perspective, being a member of the team?
Well, I mean, like I said, it was a group of guys that wanted to win one game every day. We wanted to win every game, and I'm not sure on the number, but I think we won, like, 28 games that year in our last at-bat. So, you know, we didn't ever feel like we were out of one, and, you know, just – guys hungry to win.
Do you think that series against the Padres might have gone differently? Wrigley didn't have lights, so the Cubs weren't able to have a home field advantage because of that. Played three in San Diego. Do you think that affected anything? Do you think that might have changed the outcome if the Cubs truly had home field advantage?
I think it did. Like you said, we lost home field advantage because we didn't have lights, and yet we played game five in San Diego in the daytime.
Yeah.
You know, and the umpires were on strike too, so we had amateur umpires for the first four games, college umpires, and when we got to San Diego, they would not say strike three. I mean, you know, it would strike one, strike two, and then you got to make the hitter swing to get strike three. And, you know, I can go back and watch tapes, and you could tell I was frustrated because I'm catching pitches, starting to throw it around, umpires calling it a ball, you know. It's a playoff series. You can't really get thrown out, so I couldn't say too much to him. But
yeah.
just a lot of things, that didn't go our way. But, again, we had a two-game lead, and we didn't think anybody could beat us three in a row anywhere. So, you know, it is what it is, guys. You know, San Diego played well out there, and just unfortunate.
Was there a level of shock? I imagine there was a level of shock, but can you maybe describe the emotions for yourself and in the clubhouse, like you said, after a two-game lead, and then it didn't end up going your guys' way?
Yeah, it was shock. But like I said, as a team, we didn't think anybody could beat us three in a row anywhere. So when we went to San Diego, you know, we're going to get one. And, you know, it just didn't work out. So, you know, it was kind of a shock, but then we're looking around the clubhouse, and everybody was young pretty much. And we knew, well, we'll pick this up right here next year. And then, of course, the next year, the injuries and things like that started to happen. It just didn't work out.
Where were you in 2016 as the Cubs won? And do you remember watching the game, or Game 7 specifically? Where were you during all that?
I was at a friend of mine's house over here in Bettendorf, Iowa, Ron Fuller's house. And they're huge Cub fans. I was over there bow hunting for the week. And they're sitting in their house, and I've been up early every morning and deer hunting, and I'm laying on the couch watching the game, and they're bouncing off the walls with every pitch, and they're looking at me like, don't you care if they win? And I'm going, yeah, I care. I want them to win, but me screaming at the TV ain't going to help nothing. So it was a great, great win, and so glad those guys got it for us.
What emotions did you feel? Like, was there a part of you that was disappointed that you weren't one of the you weren't on the team that was able to break this curse, this drought, whatever you want to call it?
Oh, without a doubt. And, you know, to get so close there in 84, we thought we were going to get it done. And then, like I said, we were coming back for 85, and we thought we'd just pick it up right there. And baseball's a crazy game. You can't predict injuries, and it just didn't go our way. But really, really happy for the Cub fans. You know, I mean, when we were there, you know, everybody's telling us, you know, my mom, my dad, you know, all they wanted was a Cubs World Series before they die, and they've passed. And you guys got so close, and for those guys to get it done in 16, man, really, really happy for the Cub fans.
So you're wearing your ring here. You're holding the mic in that hand. What was it like to get that ring? Like, what kind of emotions and pride do you feel for having one of those World Series rings?
It was humbling. And I'll tell you a little short story. I was actually working with the Reds as a hitting coach, and I was coming home from a spring training game. I'm sitting in rush hour traffic in Phoenix, running about 5 miles an hour, and my phone rings, and it's Crane Kinney. And I'm going, what the heck does Crane Kinney want me for? You know, and I answer the phone, and Crane goes through this spiel, and after about 2 minutes of naming certain criteria, he says, we're going to give you a World Series ring. And I said, would you say that again? And, you know, I went home and I was humble. Shoot, I went in the back room and sat down and cried for like an hour that they thought enough of me to give me a ring. And I think back to being at my buddy's house in Bettendorf, Iowa, watching game 7, and I'm going, you know, if I'd have known they were going to give me a ring, I'd have been yelling at the TV and jumping up and down, too. So it's kind of a funny story.
No, that's awesome. How shocked were you when you found out that you were getting a ring?
Oh, just completely humbled, you know, blown away. I never expected it, never had even thought about it. You know, you play your whole life trying to win one, and then for the Cubs to think enough of what I did as a player for my 8 years to give me one, man, just such an honor.
During your time as a player in the 86 season, you throw 89 runners trying to steal on you. I had to look that up multiple times to make sure that that wasn't some sort of typo on Baseball Reference. That's an insane, like, astronomical number. I mean, nowadays, catchers might not even have an opportunity to throw 89 times in a game, even with stolen bases coming back. Just can you take us through, like, that incredible season, particularly throwing out runners? What led to that? Like, how did it all come together in that way?
Well, Johnny Oates and I really worked hard in spring training of me getting rid of the ball quicker. I always felt like I had a good arm, and I was pretty accurate, but Johnny worked with me about getting rid of the ball quicker. And I think that carried into a lot of my success. And, you know, back then, though, that was the run and error. So, you know, you got guys stealing over 100 bases. And so I was getting a lot of opportunities to throw. So I think I threw out about 47%, which was – you know, that was
pretty good,
I guess.
What was the key for you, do you think, to be such an impactful two-way catcher? You know, you had a great offensive game and obviously defense, we just touched on it a bit, but, like, you know, that wasn't even huge, even in that era where there was two-way catchers. Sure, there was guys like Donnie Bench and stuff, but it wasn't on every team. And now today, maybe there is a bit, definitely more offensive skewed in the position. How were you able to balance both aspects of your game?
Well, when I first came to the big leagues, the Cubs told me, number one, and Dallas Green was the big part of that. He said, first and foremost, you're going to have to play defense if you want to play. And I'd always felt like I was a pretty good hitter. You know, I'd hit pretty well through the minor leagues. But I really had to focus on my defense. And so once I got the defense under control, you know, then I could look a little bit more to offense. Like I said, I always felt like I could hit. And once I got the defense down and the pitcher started believing in me a little bit, it just kind of took off.
I know you're a humble guy, but where would you rank yourself among the best catchers in Cubs history?
Second.
Okay. Behind?
Behind Gabby Hart. And nobody's going to get him, I don't think. I haven't looked at his numbers really close, but I know he played here a long time. And I look at his numbers when I do, and they're astronomical. I don't see anybody playing here long enough to catch Gabby. So I think I'm second in most categories behind him. And, you know, I'm pretty honored to be where I am.
What do you think is the biggest difference between baseball in the 80s and during your heyday and now? Obviously, we know there's a lot of different rules, pitch com and all that kind of stuff. But what's the biggest difference you see in the game and the product on the field?
Well, for me, it's, you know, I think we played more team baseball. You know, we did what game situations call for. Like, man on second, nobody out. You got to hit the ball to the right side and move the runner to third. You know, our your teammates, your veteran teammates, are going to hold you accountable to that, and they're going to get on you a little bit. And I just don't see that quite as much. The DH, too, has influenced the game. The pitch clock, the pitch clock's been in effect a long time in the minor leagues. So most of those guys, when they come up, you know, they're used to it. They're on that kind of pace. But you know, I don't know that I like any of the rules, because I'm an old school guy, and the way we played the game back then, and it just seems to me more like the analytics. Everybody, you know, more home runs, more strikeouts. You know, the stolen base is coming back a little bit with the rule of not throwing to first. So, you know, I'm just an old school guy. I like the way we played back in the 80s. And, you know, back then we had so much pride in not striking out. You know, it was like, God, if you strike out 100 times, you know, they may send you back to the minor leagues. And now guys strike out 200 times pretty regular. So it's a different game. I'm sure it's exciting for the younger fans to see the more home runs. And I look at it, too, like in the 80s, I played in all multi-purpose sports stadiums, all, you know, football and baseball stadiums. And now just about everybody's got their own baseball stadium. A little more home run conducive, and I think that's a lot of the reason for the home runs now.
How do you think you would have handled, that one, the pitch clock as a catcher, but two, pitch comm, you know, I mean, having the automated system to communicate with your pitcher instead of throwing down signs, what would that have done for you and changed your part of the game?
Well, I know there's no way when Sutcliffe went out there that he could have pitched under that pitch clock, because we would talk about the game, the other team pregame, and then he'd go right out there and shake me off anyway. So it would have been tough for Rick, and it would have been something to get used to, you know. I'm going, if you're going to do it that way, just put the monitor on the pitcher and let him push a button and tell the catcher what he's going to throw. So,
all right, last one before we let you go. What was your favorite memory, or maybe the thing that you're most proud of in your Cubs career? Something that you know, tell your family about, or that you sit in a quiet moment and you think, like, I'm so glad that I got to experience this, whether you did it yourself personally or you guys accomplished as a team.
Well, undoubtedly winning in 84, getting to the playoffs for the Cub fans. They were so hungry, and they've been so good throughout the years supporting the team, even when they didn't make the playoffs. That was the most fun of my career. And then, you know, I had an individual game there late in 84 that we kind of felt like pretty much clinched the division against the Mets. I had a grand slam, big moment. And then you touched on throwing out 89 guys in 86 is – I think that one might be there for a while, too.
Sounds good. Well, Jody, thanks so much for stopping by. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me, and go Cubs.
You've got the jersey, the ball cap, the foam finger. Everyone can see you're a Chicago Cubs fan from a mile away. Ready to take your look to the next level? Upgrade your wallet with an exclusive Cubs debit card, which you can get when you open a Wintrust Cubs checking account. With no monthly fees, free ATMs nationwide, and a $300 bonus when you open your account. Start showing your Cubs pride with every purchase. Sign up at Wintrust.com/Cubs. Only $100 required to open. No monthly minimum balance and no monthly maintenance fees. Member FDIC and Equal Housing Lender.
Great stuff from Jody Davis. Tony, I'm curious for you, what was your favorite part in talking with Jody Davis?
It was asking him where he would rank himself on greatest Cubs catchers of all time. So I just didn't know what to expect for that answer, right? Like, you could get, obviously these athletes have a ton of confidence in themselves. It's been quite a few years since Jody Davis has played. I wouldn't have been surprised if he said number one. I wouldn't have been surprised if he had said, you know, I haven't really thought too much about it, but like maybe I'd rank myself here, or like think through it on the pod. But he was like right away, two, behind Gabby Hartnett. And I was just like he had clearly given it some thought. And so like I thought that was a cool aspect. I thought it was like open and honest. And like, to be, you know, these players, they do give it thought. Like anybody that says they don't, I think is lying.
Yeah.
And when you're a guy like Jody Davis, who had so much success in the Cubs uniform, played here for so long, like he certainly is in that conversation for best catcher in franchise history. So I'm sure he's had those thoughts. He's gotten those questions. He's answered it however, but that was really entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about professional athletes that I'm sure you've realized and I've realized being around them is like they are great competitors, and they haven't gotten where they are, whether they're the 26th man on the roster or the star player. They haven't gotten there without being really, really competitive and believing that they're the best. Is that always the case? Maybe not, but that belief and that mindset gets them there. And
those guys, that doesn't really change just because they retire haven't played for a couple of decades.
Right.
Like, yeah, it's still there.
Like, there's guys who retire who are like, I could probably still, and it's like, well, maybe you can, but probably not. Like, you're probably retired for a reason. But it's always interesting to see that mindset that I think separates really the professional athletes from like those guys that were just good growing up or things like that. So
definitely.
I'm not surprised that Jody Davis, thought like that and thinks like that. And it's really refreshing to see that. But it was a great conversation with Jody Davis. It's been great catching up with all these Cubs alumni. You can catch them all on the Cubs Weekly podcast. You can catch them on the Marquee Sports Network app in video form. So that'll do it for this edition of the Cubs Weekly podcast presented by WinTrust. For Tony and Draghi, I'm Andy Martinez. Thanks for tuning in.